From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we talk with Mark Abrahams. He's the founder and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize about this year's Ig Nobel ceremony and the winners that was held on September 12th. Who knew that there was a scientific study about real plants trying to imitate the shape of artificial plastic plants? Then, Fraser Kane from Universe Today joins to talk about his website, podcast, and YouTube channel that are great sources for everything on the latest in research and discoveries about space. Well, what do real plants trying to imitate the shape of artificial plastic plants have in common with the feasibility of housing live pigeons inside missiles and demonstrating that fake medicine that causes painful side effects can be more effective than fake medicine that does not cause painful side effects? Well, these studies and experiments were all winners of the 2024 Ig Nobel Award given out on September 12th. Here to tell us about these winners and others is Mark Abrahams, founder and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize. Mark, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. What strange questions you were saying there at the beginning. And I was admiring the way you were able to get them all out so smoothly and clearly.
That took a lot of practice.
Yeah.
Well, let's first talk about the 2024 Ig Nobel Award. This was the first time let me rephrase this. This was the 34th first annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony, and it was held live in person September 12th at MIT. This was the first in-person event in 4 years, right?
Right. And for anybody who is not familiar with this, the Ig Nobel Prizes are prizes. We've been doing this every year since 1991. And they're prizes for things that are so surprising that they make people laugh and then think. And that's it. These are not prizes saying this is the very best something in the world or this is the very worst or anything like that. It's because each one of these things makes almost anybody laugh and then think.
And looking at this year's award winners and last year's award winners, yes, they do come across as funny. They do make you think, but this is all legitimate real science. And these people have put their professional lives into studying these things. So you don't take this lightly. It's not like you're making fun of these studies that you award.
Yeah. And these are not all of them necessarily about science. It's anything that makes people laugh and then think. Some years we give out a peace prize. We did this year. Some years we give out a literature prize. It can be almost anything. And it really can get at the question of what is important. You know, every day all of us are told in the news and by the people we work with and by our friends, this is important and that thing is worthless and all. And maybe all of those instructions we're getting are right, but maybe sometimes that's not the whole story.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Mark Abrahams. He's the founder and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize, and he's telling us about the 2024 Ig Nobel Award winners. Well, let's talk about this year's winners. You gave away 10 prizes. So back to the Peace Prize.
Yeah.
I had to read it a couple of times to really understand it. Well, okay, not really understand it, but get an idea of what they were talking about.
Uh-huh.
And this was given to a group out of the U.S., and this was an experiment to see the feasibility of housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths of missiles. Were any pigeons actually harmed in this study?
No, nor were any missiles, nor was anybody else. This was done a long time ago. This was done in the lead up to World War II. When the American military was seeing what was happening in Europe, where there was a war going on there, and it was looking like we're going to be involved too. The German military had a lot of airplanes that seemed to be a lot more capable of doing all kinds of stuff than anything anybody else had. So they were starting to worry about how do we make our own so we don't get killed. And they started wanting to have missiles because the other guys were making these things that were effectively missiles. to get the missiles to go where you want them, that's not easy. You know, even if you throw a rock at a fence to get hit the fence where you want it, that's not easy. People came up with the idea that there are a lot of animals that seem to travel all over the place and can be made kind of instructed to do that. In particular, racing pigeons, you know, were a big thing for a long time. And there were some biologists who did a lot of work trying to figure out how these pigeons are able to do this and how people are able to train pigeons to do that. Somehow that boiled down into this idea of, you know, if we could train pigeons to sit inside the front of a missile with a window and recognize the territory, because we will give them pictures beforehand, wouldn't that be great? Because the pigeons could guide the missiles. They even thought, this is stupid, this is crazy, and it's kind of funny. But they started to do some little experiments, and they discovered that, you know, this just might be possible. And so that's what this was about. And they discovered that, yeah, it just might be possible. But it was a case of, it seemed so crazy to everybody involved that they never really completely pursued it. And it got mostly forgotten until now, when we gave a prize to B.F. Skinner, who was for a long time a big name in psychology. He was the main person in this. Now, he's not been alive for many years, but his daughter, Julie, is very much alive. She's in her 80s and very lively. She came to the ceremony and accepted the Ig Nobel Prize on behalf of her father and pointed out that her father, too, thought this thing was crazy and hilarious. But he was also very proud of what questions were being raised here.
Well, another question that was raised, and I'm dying to know the answer to this, and it was the Anatomy Prize mm-hmm. for studying whether the hair on the heads of most people in the Northern Hemisphere swirls in the same direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, as hair on the heads of most people in the Southern Hemisphere. It kind of, to me, it harkens back to that question, does a toilet flush in the same direction in the same hemisphere? So, all right, what did they find out about this hair swirling conundrum?
Well, they found out that it's an interesting question. That's pretty much all they ended up finding out. And it started when one of these scientists, a woman who had given birth not so long ago to twins, and was looking at their heads, and, you know, babies don't have nearly as much hair as adults, so you can see the patterns of the hair a lot more easily. And she started talking to other people, other mothers and other scientists about this, and it turned out pretty much nobody seemed to have any idea about how these patterns, is it transmitted in families? Does it have to do with what you eat when you're young? They kind of jokingly pointed out that the thing you pointed out about water swirling in one direction in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. By the way, that only works on a big scale, like in oceans. It doesn't work when you get down to smaller amounts of swirling, like toilets.
No matter how many times you flush your friend's toilets when you're visiting in Melbourne, you're never going to find out that answer.
Well, I just told you that, but, you know, don't take my word for anything. Go and try it if you have a friend in Melbourne. And you're in the Northern Hemisphere like you and I are. Keep trying. I'd love to hear the answer you get. So anyway, they started to look into it, and that's what this was really all about.
And did they find any conclusive evidence?
No, they found all kinds of hints, because a lot of people have tried to figure that out about all kinds of things, about a similar kind of question that also doesn't really have an answer because nobody's found one, is right-handedness and left-handedness. You know, we all kind of think that it's passed down in families, but nobody's really sure about that. A lot of scientists have spent a lot of time and effort trying to figure it out, looking at families and lots of other stuff. And it turns out to be one of those questions that the closer you look, the more it turns into murk, into just a whole series of other questions, which are all really interesting, but nobody really knows the answer to any of them. They're mysteries.
Yeah, it's nice to have mysteries in life, though. All right, let's talk about the botany.
Nice to know sometimes that something really is a mystery. It's not that you don't know it, that, you know, that you're ignorant and everybody else knows it. This is a hard question.
Right. I think there's so many people are driven to know the answers to everything, which is, I think, so much of the foundation of these amazing awards and research that are done by the people that you give this prize to. Because they go and they try and ask these questions that most of us either disregard or haven't even thought of.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are questions that maybe we'll never be able to answer.
Yeah, and sometimes there are questions that feel like that for a long time until somebody somehow notices what the answer is. And after that, then it seems obvious. Then everybody knows it, of course.
Well, let's talk about the Botany Prize, because this one cracked me up, and it's for finding evidence that some real plants imitate the shape of neighboring artificial plastic plants. What?
There's a particular kind of plant. The Latin name for it is Bochila trifoliata. And the people who were around that plant had noticed for a long, long time that, gee, the shape of the leaves quite often seems to be different in different plants. And quite often the shape of the leaves of this plant are exactly the same as whatever plant is next to them. You know, very, very different shapes. That's pretty strange. Don't seem to be any plants that behave like that, but this one does. So people, you know, some scientists have been trying to figure this out, but not a lot. It's a pretty obscure question. And nobody could make any sense of it. People had all kinds of ideas. And finally, these two scientists decided, all right, let's do the most extreme thing we can think of. Let's put it next to something that's not even alive, that's not even a real plant, just something that looks like a plant, something that's plastic, you know, one of those things you buy in the supermarket. Let's have this real plant grow next to one of these plastic things and see what happens. And they got kind of freaked out, because what happened was the same thing. The real plant grew its leaves in the same shape as the plastic plant next to it. So they did this a lot of times to assure themselves that this really keeps happening. They don't have any good idea of how this happens. They have some wild guesses, and they're very emphatic about saying they don't understand it. It's crazy, but it seems to be quite real. This is a mystery.
Yeah, and that's a mystery that would definitely be interesting to have it solved, because that's not something you've typically seen in plants before. I mean, they'll rotate towards the sun, but imitating a plastic plant next to them.
If you could know how that happens in the plant, maybe something like that happens in lots of other plants and explains, you know, other things about plants that nobody's even thought to ask a question.
Right. Maybe we aren't giving plants enough credit.
Always give plants more credit. That's a good, kind rule for life.
Yes, exactly, in a number of ways.
But not too much credit.
No.
Don't go overboard on things.
Well, let's talk about dedication to the craft. A study from, it was a big group from the Netherlands, Switzerland, Belgium, France, Germany, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. They showed, in theory, and by 357 experiments, that's a lot of coin tossing, that when you flip a coin, it tends to land on the same size as it started. How do you track that much data? What did that really prove?
People had looked at the question of whether a coin will, in theory, when you describe it with math, whether it will keep coming up, you know, a fair number of times, a 50-50 thing, no matter how many times you do it. And they kept finding that given the way people are shaped and the motions and all, that if you do a lot of them almost always, it won't work out to exactly 50-50. That there'll always be, if you do a lot of them, there'll always be a little imbalance to it, that it will end up a little more often landing the same way it started, you know, the way you were holding it when you tossed it, it'll land that on that same side. And okay, so the math seems to say this, but you know, are you going to trust it? So that's what these people in Europe did. They I forget how long they took. I think they set aside a weekend or something and got a whole bunch of people and a whole bunch of food and just locked themselves in a big house or something. And they flipped coins all weekend, 300 whatever thousand times, and kept records of it. And the question that you asked, how do you even keep track of that when you're doing it? They spent a lot of time trying to be very careful about that. And at the end of it, when they looked at the records of all of those coin flips and all the people doing it, it came out almost exactly the way the predictions said.
Wow. Do you think about that? Like you just said, you know, coin flipping to most of us is just something that everybody does, and everybody probably flips the same way. Yeah. But we all have different size fingers, flipping strength, all of those things. And so my average of coin flips, coin tosses would not be the same as yours, just because of the mechanics that we would use to flip that coin.
Yeah, and yet if we did it enough times, it might not turn out to be that different either.
350,000 times maybe.
yeah. So set aside a weekend to try that with a bunch of friends. And keep good records.
In the intro, I talked about fake medicine. And so I'm going to say this again. It's a mouthful. The medicine prize was given for demonstrating that fake medicine that causes painful side effects can be more effective than fake medicine that does not cause painful side effects. It's fake medicine. So how is it being effective?
Yeah, well, that's the heart of the question. There are these, you know, there's this nice kind of fancy word, placebo, which is something that doctors, and long before doctors existed, everybody used. You know, you've got somebody in the family who's not feeling well, and you say, you know, here, drink some of this stuff I just made and gave you, and, you know, it's water or something. And people will usually feel a little better just from that. So something like that is going on here. This was some people trying to poke at how does this work, you know, and when does it work and when doesn't it work, and does it work with some people more than others and all that. And in poking around to try to understand better the limits of that stuff, they sometimes would give people some fake medicine and then give some other people some fake medicine along with something that hurt a little bit. And then other people give nothing at all. And they discovered that for quite a few people, when they took some medicine and it made them uncomfortable, you know, it hurt. Those suffering people would come out of it feeling that, yeah, you know, it was painful when I took the medicine, but it worked better than the other medicine. That
gives a whole new meaning to the saying, no pain, no gain.
It's a good question you're raising here. So it's really very mysterious. And for doctors, of course, this means life is always complicated, that when you're treating somebody, you know, you're treating them in the way you think. If you're putting together, you know, broken bones, that's one thing. But if it's anything where it's not so clear and visible what you're doing, it's not so clear and visible to the person that you're helping or trying to help. And it's not so clear to that person whether they're really getting better or not, you know, as far as comfort and discomfort. It's all a lot more difficult than it looks from the outside.
Well, and so many of the medications that we take, it's trust. I mean, trust based on scientific evidence, but we don't see the interactions of these medications in our systems. Oh. We just know that we feel better or we don't. It's magic, isn't it? All right, let's talk about the study, Supercentenarians and the Oldest Old are concentrated into regions with no birth certificates and short lifespans. So this was the demography prize given out for a group in Australia and the UK for detective work to discover that many of the famous people for having the longest lives lived in places that had lousy birth and death record keeping. So we really have no idea how old they were?
Yeah, there have been for a lot of years now, many reports in the news about, you know, a woman in France who lived to be 122, a woman in Greece who lived, a man who lived in wherever. About 20 years ago or so, somebody put together a lot of the stories of these things and said that, look, when you plot these on a map, you can see there are a handful of places in the world that seem to be very special, that the people who live in these particular regions seem to live much longer lives. And they started to give them a name. They called them blue zones. They wrote books about that and all sorts of stuff. And then other people started pointing out that, well, you know, maybe the diet of the people there is different. Some of these things are in the Mediterranean Sea area. So there is a Mediterranean diet. That must be the reason. All of these stories grew up very elaborate. This guy, he's an academic, and he's an academic in a field that sounds really dull. The name is demography. You know, they study numbers of people. How many people live here? How many people used to live there? How many people who have red hair live here? And all, it doesn't seem too interesting to most people. It's numbers. But he went and he got really curious about these reports, and he started looking for the records of these specific people who were reported as being famously having a long life. And he discovered that for most of them, there were either no records or records you wouldn't trust. A lot of them live in places where there are no birth certificates. So you're taking it completely on somebody's word. You don't know whose word that, you know, this person who lived to be 117 really was born in 1891 or whatever. Some people had three birth certificates in different years. All right, now that's on the birth end. On the other end, he discovered in a lot of places that there were a lot of individuals who were still very, very old. And when he went and looked up the records on them and went, discovered that they had been getting a pension for many, many years, for decades, which is nice, you know, being paid once you get too old. And their family was benefiting from this. And that, oh gosh, gee, it turned out that this person died about 30 years ago, but the family never told the government, and so continued to get pension checks. And so on one end, there apparently is a lot of fraud going on. So add the two together, and he looked up a lot of these records in all of these places. And he said, look, all you have to do is go look at the evidence, and these stories were being told, they're just stories.
Well, this year, like I said at the beginning, this year was the first year in four you'd had an in-person ceremony. And you always bring in Nobel laureates that are roped into handing out the awards to the Ig Nobel.
We don't rope anybody. We just invite people and they decide.
Has anyone ever said no?
Oh, sure. You know, we invite people to do things, and some people want to and some people don't. Some of them seem to enjoy it and keep coming back year after year. The ceremony is a lot of fun. We had it at MIT here in Massachusetts this year. And except for the four pandemic years, we've had a big ceremony. So people come, people buy tickets. So we have a big room jammed with people. Many of them have traveled a great distance. We have the winners who've traveled, many of them literally halfway around the world to get here in secret, because we keep the winners secret until the moment we introduce them on stage. We got a bunch. We had, what, five people who have Nobel Prizes who were there shaking hands with the winners and handing the prizes to them, and a whole bunch of other stuff. The audience throws paper airplanes. There's a little opera that we write one every year about something in science.
Don't forget Cutie Pie.
And yeah, to keep all the speeches short, because there are 10 prizes and all sorts of other stuff. And if we didn't really keep control of it, it would stretch, you know, until dawn or beyond. So our main timekeeping mechanism is something we invented probably about 25 years ago now. We always go out and very carefully find a very special kind of 8-year-old child, work with the parents. And you may have met a few of these people, but they're very rare. They're usually girls, not boys. And there's something about that age of eight. There's some power that these people have, especially at that age. She sits on the side of the stage, this little girl. And whenever she feels somebody has talked long enough, which is about 1 minute, she'll tell them. She gets up, and while they're talking, while this winner is giving a speech, this little girl gets up, walks all the way across the stage, goes right up to the person who's talking, looks up at them and says, please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. And that works.
Yeah, I bet.
We ever since we invented that, we have always finished the ceremony pretty close to what we intended the full running time to be, 90 minutes. But without the power of that little kid, we couldn't do it.
Yeah. I know that on your website, which we will post on our website, you have the video of this year's 2024 34th first annual Ig Nobel ceremony, and take the time to watch it because it will bring you such delight and knowledge. It'll make you laugh and think, because I remember, I think it was 2005 or six, I was at home canning peaches because it was September and I had NPR on and the Ig Nobels came on, and I have been hooked ever since.
Let me say also, if you watch the video, and also most of the previous years are up there, look at the faces of the other people. Look at how they're reacting to each other. There is such a crazy, complicated show of people bouncing off each other there.
It's fantastic. Well, Mark, thank you for coming back to Cool Science Radio and sharing with us this year's winners. We are always happy to have you on, and thanks, we Katie. Look forward to next year.
Till then.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
With so much happening overhead and beyond, where can one turn for the latest information? Well, you can start your own website and compile all of the discoveries, theories, research, and other things that interest you. Well, back in 1999, 25 years ago, that is exactly what our next guest did. Fraser Cain, founder, curator, editor, podcaster, and probably web manager, joins us to talk about his amazing resource, Universe Today, Space and Astronomy News. Fraser, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. I think you covered most of my tasks there. That's pretty good.
Okay.
You know, janitor, HR.
Accounting, the joys of owning your
accounting,
own business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But absolutely, webmaster, web developer. Yeah, all of it.
Well, you have been doing Universe Today for 25 years. That's an amazing feat to have that kind of longevity. Give our listeners a quick summary of what it is, of what the website is.
Yeah, I mean, so Universe Today is really an extension of my own curiosity about space and astronomy. And so it started as a way for me to learn more about space and astronomy. I'd always been interested in it, but was working in the tech field as a developer and wanted to sort of keep touch with this hobby that I had all my life. And within a couple of months, really, of doing this, I realized that this is all I want to do for the rest of my life. And now it's a matter of figuring out how to turn that into a living. And over time, I became a journalist. I sort of tracked various sources, read science journals, turned them into articles that people could understand for a lay audience. I layered on podcasting with various shows and eventually added video. And sort of now it's a fairly, you know, still a fairly small, but very comprehensive resource for publishing space and astronomy news to the world.
I have to say, I found your website about a year ago, and we've actually had one guest so far that I found her research on your site. And so found it so interesting, went and found her. She was in Iceland doing some work. And so you really are such a comprehensive source for all sorts of topics. Well, what is your background? You know, you say now that you're basically a science writer and a science editor, but you started in tech. Did you have a background in science journalism or writing as well?
No. So my background was, as a kid, I was always into space and astronomy. I watched meteor showers. I watched the lunar eclipses. I watched rocket launches with my parents. My parents were very into science fiction and science. I bought my own telescope when I was 14. I joined the journalism program at high school and reported on various space and astronomy, like stuff you could watch in the sky, how to find the Big Dipper, in my high school newspaper. And then I went to the University of British Columbia for engineering, left that to go work at a tech startup, did that for several years, and sort of forgot that I was really into space and astronomy. And it was this happenstance that I was like, I had this sort of desire to recover this part of my enthusiasm for space. I was reading Carl Sagan and I read a bunch of his books. I was reading Pale Blue Dot. I'm like, I want to know more about this. And so that kind of led into it. And then at the same time, as another sort of hobby, I was writing for the role-playing game industry. So I was writing like source books and material for games like Shadowrun. And so I had a lot of practice writing. And so I sort of brought the two together so that I was spending a lot of time writing about this topic that I was very interested in. And so that's sort of, so no formal education in it, but I don't think the the job requires a lot of formal education. It more requires about doing an enormous volume of work. I track right now that I write the equivalent of a novel, you know, like 100,000 words about every month, right? So if I just like turned it all into novel, everything I write, if I turned it into novels, it would be whatever, 12 novels a year, right? Mm-hmm. Just through all of the work that I write. And that's how you get there.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Fraser Cain. He is a podcaster. He's a journalist. He is the founder of the Universe Today website and the podcast by the same name. And Fraser, it's funny because people often say, oh, I feel like I have a mini master's, or I got a master's degree in XYZ that they spend a lot of time doing. I feel like you have a PhD and then some postdoc in what you do and your interest in space. And it really gives credibility to the fact that with keen interest and commitment, here you are 25 years later with this website or is it the podcast or website? I read, you know, that you have tens of millions of followers. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the numbers, because I'd love for our listeners to know and to have this resource, because you're so clear. Everything that you talk about, the layperson can grasp.
Yeah. I mean, back to the education side, I mean, I'm really lucky. I do the Astronomy Cast podcast with Dr. Pamela Gay. She is a PhD astronomer, and we're up to mid 700s in our episodes. We've been doing the show for 17 years now. And that's a big chunk of me getting my education. Is I just got, you know, every week I get to ask Pamela for an hour straight every question that I have about space and astronomy, and she patiently answers them. So that is a huge sort of through line in what I've done. And so if you know, anyone who had access to a PhD for 16 years and could just ask every question that you wanted over and over and over again, you'd pack on a lot of knowledge. But what are numbers on the internet? It's really tricky to sort of put an analysis to the amount of numbers. So the website itself gets several million visitors a month. I send out a weekly email newsletter to about 75,000 people. I have about 500,000 subscribers on YouTube. The podcast gets about 200,000 downloads a month. I don't really care about my Twitter or any of that stuff anymore. Yeah.
And what I find is that with each, for example, each podcast episode, you're really dealing with a couple of different things. It might be an hour-long podcast, but you're answering a lot of questions you get from your listeners. Do you feel like overall we have become more keenly interested and curious in space since we have been touched by some of these phenomenon like the eclipses and things like that, especially in the Western Canada, Western U.S.?
I think part of the problem, or not the problem necessarily, but there's sort of two kinds of space nerds. There's the one type that was like me before I started to read the Carl Sagan, which was that there's this institutional knowledge and understanding about space and astronomy. People who watch Cosmos when they were younger, or maybe the new Cosmos show, that you watch the space documentaries where they come on television and you enjoy them, and you know vaguely that SpaceX is launching and so on. But then there's this other group that starts to follow the journey, starts to really understand the up-to-date things that are happening in space and astronomy with the level of enthusiasm that someone might have following a sports team. And then your knowledge becomes a lot more specific and detailed, and you see it as an unfolding story as new discoveries are being made that are layered on top of one another. And so for the layperson, they know that there's this thing called the great attractor, and it's, ooh, it's weird and it's mysterious. And what could it be? But the people who are into it have watched year after year as the various galaxies in the great attractor are mapped out one by one as we're using new technology and we're seeing through the center of the Milky Way, and have a really comprehensive understanding of what this thing is. It is not a gigantic mystery. It's a blob of galaxies on the other side of the Milky Way, and we know roughly how many there are and where they are, right? And so I think that for the people who start to go down that pathway, as they learn more about the universe and as they learn about the discoveries, they get more invested in the unfolding story that is going on, which is us querying nature and it telling us the truth.
Well, Fraser, it's funny. Lynn is more of a podcast follower and I'm more of a website reader. So which means we cover all of your bases, if you will. So on your website and on the podcast, you must be sourcing from hundreds of places because there's a diversity of articles. Of course, they're all universe related, but where do you go and how do you find access to this great research?
So, I mean, that is the 25-year journey, which is that I am building up a repository of sources day after day, week after week that I follow. I mainly do this through RSS, which is a favorite technology that not a lot of people are really knowledgeable about anymore, but it's essentially a way to go through a huge list of bookmarks every single day. And I probably have about 1,000 sources in my RSS feed. And then each one of those sources can generate, in some cases, one story, two stories. In the case of, say, journals, it can be 100 stories every single day that I look through. And I have a sort of a trigger that I'm like, I'm looking for things that I'm curious about, things that patch in pieces of my knowledge that I don't feel like I understand completely. I'm a lot more interested in the stuff that nobody else is talking about, stuff that is interesting and valuable, but just maybe hasn't gotten the coverage from the mainstream media or the coverage even from the press officers at the university where the people are making the discoveries. You know, I on the one hand know kind of what is in the zeitgeist for the day. And then I look at this much larger list and think, what is interesting and what am I curious about specifically? And so, and then I have a fairly great, you know, I have a great team of writers who I am grabbing all of these sources and handing them all off to them. And then they take the ball and run with them and turn them into articles, which is great for me because I get to just focus on satisfying my curiosity and starting the journey. And then other people can pick up and actually do the underlying reporting to get the story out for the audience. And I don't have to write every word on the website, which is great. So that, I mean, it's just every morning I go through a list of 1,000 sources looking for stuff that I think is going to meet my criteria. And then I start again the next day. I am so curious and I am, you know, the more I learn about this, the more things that I find, and I just don't have time in the day to explore each one of these. And so the fact that I can have, in many cases, writers with PhDs who can get to the bottom of the story. So it's amazing. It's amazing, right? That we get to, and then I get to fulfill the curiosity of other people in a way that I just wouldn't be able to do. If it was just me, I would be able to find one story a day and take it to fruition. But in this case, we can do 10, which is great.
Well, speaking of questions, one of the things that I think is so refreshing to see on your Patreon account, which, you know, people want to join $3 a month to help support this amassing of knowledge. You've got this great questions section. And I think so many of us get used to questions and comments on typical social media or other posts that are just inane or mean or rude. But all the questions that are coming through on your Patreon account are really, really interesting, well thought out. Do you have a favorite question or topic that people ask that really gets you going?
So no, like I really enjoy the process of answering questions. I love the iteration. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's no stupid questions. And I really kind of do believe that if a person is genuinely asking a question that they don't know the answer to, and they don't realize that the question has been asked 1,000 times before, it's not that the question hasn't been answered. It's just that they haven't run across a satisfying version of the answer so that hunger for knowledge has been fulfilled. And it's really kind of great. I enjoy the process. It's like, it's nourishing to have a person who has a question and have them walk away with an answer that then allows them to then ask a next question, right? And I really enjoy that process. And it's funny because when I have friends who are astronomers and they're like, oh, it's exhausting to have to answer these questions for people. I'm like, send them my way. I love it. I'll take more, right? Yeah. And so, no, I don't have any favorite questions. I mean, we have memes on the channel where we joke about how I get a lot of Lagrange point questions, these sort of stable balancing points of orbit, and people just can't, you know, every possible version of, you know, how Lagrange points work has been asked. And for the longest time, that was like on my thumbnail, was Lagrange pointing at me asking questions. But apart from that, no, as long as the person who is asking the question is genuinely looking for an answer, then I am just absolutely happy to fulfill that. It's when the people are being mean-spirited, they are not at, they're not actually honestly asking a question, they're looking to troll you, they're, you know, then that's just exhausting and frustrating. And what's great about Patreon is that these are the people who support us. These are people who are putting down money every month to support the work that we do as an independent science journalism agency. And so they, you know, there's some skin in the game. And so I find that their questions are raw and honest and really worth answering.
Well, speaking of podcast episodes, and while you talk about space and the universe, you put up an episode about a week ago that you say was an unusual interview for your channel here about AI. And you talked to someone who is part of the Pause AI movement. Can you take us through that? Just give us an overview, and why did you include that?
Well, so my degree, after I left my engineering degree, I got my degree in computer science. So that really my background, if you sort of go all the way back, what is my formal scientific knowledge? It's computer science. And I am in day-to-day working with various tools as I develop Universe Today. And so obviously I was quite keyed into the sort of the development of artificial intelligence tools like ChatGPT, Claude AI, and things like that. And at the same time, I was very aware of the larger philosophical issues of, you know, what does it mean for us to create a technology that is potentially smarter than us? You know, it didn't go well for other species when human beings showed up. And so we should at least be aware of what the potential risks and downsides are of that technology. And over time, I haven't found anybody who has given a satisfying answer to what is the solution to this problem. That there's a lot of hand wavy, there's a lot of feel, it feels like it's going to be okay, which doesn't feel satisfying to me. I want to see some mathematical proof that it's going to be fine, that you have solved the safety issue, that we know how to align the technology, that we know how to make sure that it doesn't scale beyond what we're capable of handling. And so I have been sort of watching a lot of influential thinkers in this space. Like, it's kind of like my, you know, while people are watching my stuff, I'm watching people think about the advances in technology, both at how it's going to be practical for me, but also just like, what does this mean for humanity to face this next phase in our development? And so it was just like a fluke. The Pause AI people reached out to me and said, do you want to have an interview with Dr. Roman Yampolsky? And I had just listened to several interviews with him and really resonated with his perspective, and found that other interviewers had done a really mediocre job of interviewing him. And, you know, part of my bread and butter is just interviewing scientists, astronomers. And so I thought it would be fun to take on the interview. And so I couldn't say no, turn down an interview with someone who I really enjoyed their perspective. And they were being handed to me on a silver platter by the company. So I took the interview.
What does or does not make you feel like AI is sort of like extraterrestrial life on our planet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are creating something that is entirely alien, that we feed it this enormous amount of data, and then it has this giant inscrutable matrix where it is compiling answers and useful work comes out the other side, where you run the technology and you give it a mathematical problem and solutions. You know, the most recent version from ChatGPT could do well on a math Olympiad, which I don't think is a prediction. If you 10 years ago said, oh yeah, we're going to have a computer that you feed it math problems and it will answer them as well as someone on the math Olympiad, you would be skeptical. And yet here we are, right? And we have internalized. We're like, well, you know, like why wouldn't it, right? Why couldn't it write a poem in the style of, you know, one poet while, you know, having a, you know, style of another person? Like, it's crazy what these things do. And so I think that us creating, you know, this alien intelligence here on Earth in a way that we don't know how it works. Like, you talk to any artificial intelligence researcher, you say, why did it write the poem? They say, why did it choose the words that it chose? They're like, I don't know, like it just does. And so that, and yet each year it's more powerful. And how do we think this will turn out? Like, eventually it feels like there will be issues, right? That it will, someone will, you know, we will rely on this technology more and more to make choices about hiring, choices about the environment, choices about technology. And then it will make baffling choices that we won't understand why it did it. And there will be repercussions in the world that we will then have to clean up. And these will become, the more we rely on the technology to make the decisions for us, the more there are risks and issues. And, you know, like, I'm not a Luddite. I love this stuff. I love this technology. I just want it to work in our benefit and not be unpredictable and have consequences that we couldn't have predicted.
Right. And we're already seeing some of these consequences of it just running amok and making decisions. And we just automatically believe what AI is telling us. Well, let's switch back to the universe. Has there been any news lately, either from James Webb or any of these other great telescopes out there, that has really excited you? Because James Webb is constantly throwing stuff at us. But what has really gotten you excited lately from the astronomy world?
Wow. So it's funny, like, I'm so deep in the weeds, and I think my audience is as well. So it's almost like I need a level to go to, you know, to use a sports ball analogy. You know, we could talk about the injury to the wrist of the person who's throwing the ball onto this team and what the recovery plan is, or we could talk about how, you know, people are having more concussions, right? There's a story worth following. And so as it relates to astronomy, you know, we are months away from the first light of this incredible new telescope that's being built in Chile called the Vera Rubin Observatory. Mm. And when it comes online, it is going to be scanning the entire night sky from the Southern Hemisphere every three nights or so at a level of depth that rivals the capabilities of all the other telescopes. So imagine, you know, you've got the most powerful telescopes on Earth, and they are pointing at one specific target and they're taking a bunch of pictures and then scientists are studying them. Well, this one's going to look at the whole sky at that level of depth, and the astronomers can just read a database and find all of the new supernova that happened, all of the new asteroids that are crossing our path, all of the comets. It's going to be a level of data dump that humanity has never faced. I mean, they're thinking about how you can make the pipeline handle exabytes of data. And this will tell us what the universe is doing when we weren't looking. You know, we know of maybe 1,500 type 1A supernova, which are used as a yardstick in distance in the cosmos. This telescope will, over the course of its run, give us more than a million. And it's just, you have that vastly increased level of resolution. And what this gets you is we get answers about, you know, the expansion rate of the universe, the concentration of matter in different areas. And so I think this is the one that I am most focused on as delivering huge results for science. My plan is, like, when Vera Rubin comes online, they're actually going to have a filter that is processing the data as it's being gathered so that astronomers can see really interesting things immediately. Like, oh, a supernova just happened 3 minutes ago. And so I want to, like, do a live stream. And this is so nerdy, I know. I want to do a live stream with a couple of astronomers where we're just watching this data stream, like a ticker tape, and going, oh, a supernova in this galaxy. Okay, what do we know about that? Okay, it's this galaxy. Oh, it's a very active galaxy for supernova creation, and it just had one. It's this kind. Oh, an asteroid was just found, you know? We've never had that in astronomy before. James Webb is sending so much amazing material out. And I think the part at the larger scale, the thing that's really interesting, is just this new understanding of the universe in the first billion years or so, that we are seeing galaxies that were forming a lot larger, more massive. They had more mature shapes, spiral shapes. They had much larger supermassive black holes that were gobbling up data, reaching a billion times the mass of the sun within the first billion years of the universe, that we're seeing quasars activity. And so it really feels like the universe got sorted out its maturity a lot quicker than anybody had ever anticipated. And that leads more evidence to certain kinds of theories about how the early universe evolved compared to other ones. And so it's really fulfilling one of its main requirements, which was to shine a light into this time when the rest of the universe unfolded. And we just didn't have a lot of answers because nobody had built a telescope powerful enough and pristine enough to be able to get those answers. And now we're getting them. the analogy I like to give, like people are always such huge fans of the Hubble Deep Field, right? This amazing long duration picture that was taken by Hubble over dozens of hours. Webb can do a deep field anywhere it wants to look in less than an hour, just can spit them out one after the other. It's incredible what this telescope can do.
It's incredible. We were talking with some of the developers of Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope at the Bryce Astronomy Festival. They had a great analogy of the Hubble view field was like an inch by inch square, whereas Nancy Grace Roman was an 11 by 17 piece of paper, if you were to kind of compare the size of scope.
Which is a whole other mission that we didn't even talk about that I'm also incredibly, but it's farther out. And so we're waiting, you know, it's still a couple of years away, but that you're taking roughly the same size of telescope, but with really modern technology, optics, and you are doing these incredibly large scans of the heavens with the telescope. Yeah. Another amazing mission.
I can guarantee all of our listeners that all of this information as it comes out will be posted on Universe Today and on Fraser's podcast. Our guest today has been Fraser Cain. He is the founder, operator, owner of universetoday.com. Fascinating resource for universe news. And what's the name of your podcast?
Universe Today podcast.
Okay. We will have all the links in our show notes so people can go and follow you and support you on Patreon and keep this information going. Well, Fraser, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Keep looking up.
You've been listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. If you have ideas for a future show, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.